Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Friday the 13th, actually. Yeah, if you're superstitious, good luck to you today. I'm superstitious, kind of, sort of, not really. But more about sports than anything else. Yeah, so I'm not really superstitious. Just a little bit. I'm respectful of things that look like they shouldn't be screwed with. And, yeah, so I believe in luck when it comes to sports and stuff like that. But in the rest of life, not so much. You know, and but I will say this, sometimes bad things tend to find the same people over and over. I mean, my kids say that about me. I don't really believe that. Good Friday morning to you. I woke up, as happens to me on occasion, at about 2 in the morning. And I rolled over a few times. And when I didn't go back to sleep right away, I started doing a little reading. Now, there's a website that I've seen called Just the News, right? And it's a pretty righty website. They say they're independent, and with part of their work, they can validate that. So there's a social media thing out there called Parlor, which is French for to speak, right? I think my French is still halfway decent. Yeah, I think a semester or two of French, and so I saw it's a conservative social media website that doesn't sell your data and, you know, doesn't censor conservative point of views. So I have found the whole censorship thing pretty creepy. I think, like a lot of Americans have, that, you know what, when you're censoring and you only seem to censor one side, I mean, that's Animal Farm, that's Orwellian, right? That's not American. So I joined. It's not relative to Twitter, right, where if you're looking for an impromptu conversation to follow or at least look at, it's not as mature as that. So, but I did run across, and I started listening to it, And then as I started listening to it, I kept listening to it for about a half hour. And that is an interview that was done with let's see if it's on their podcast, with a how about TV? It was an interview that they did with a guy from Georgia. And he's a Democrat. And if I can find it here, I'll play a few snippets of it, because I thought, you know what? Why don't more of us believe in fairness? Why don't more of us think that it's important, right, that the truth comes out? Why is that such a unique point of view, no matter what? And so it's pretty, the world we're living in my opinion, pretty fucking creepy, if you ask me. And a lot of the stuff that I see, I would have said, no, come on, man. In the United States, that's going to happen? And so, John Solomon, the guy's name is Vernon Jones. Okay, now I'm going to read you, I'm going to tell you about Vernon Jones here in a second. Okay? And then I'm going to play a few minutes of the interview. I'll tell you what, the other interview I'm going to play a few minutes of is Justice Alito. And then Barack Obama's got a book where, I mean, so if you haven't watched What Killed Michael Brown, watch What Killed Michael Brown. Because you begin to understand the race card as it's played in this country, right? The race card is never about helping black people. Because if you were really going to help black people, you would be honest with them and saying, look, if you're looking for the federal government to rescue you, you'll die in this place, okay? You will die in this place. You've got to tighten your belt. You got to set your jaw, and you got to work yourself and educate yourself out of this place and move as quick as you can. Okay. That's the truth. The truth is nobody's coming to help you. You know, it's a similar message in post-traumatic winning. If you think the federal government or the VA is going to come and rescue you, I got a message for you. Look at the statistics. Statistics say not so much. So anyway, and I'm not hating on anybody. I'm just saying, come on, if you want to help somebody, got to start with the truth, right? So who is Vernon Jones? Now, I don't know, because I was laying in bed. So he's a conservative black representative from Georgia. He's an American politician, served as a state representative in the Georgia House of Representatives since 2017. A member of the Democratic Party, Jones was chief executive officer of DeKalb County from 2001 to 2009, which is, you know, a pretty big county, so a pretty big job. 60 years old. He was born in Laurel Hill, North Carolina. He's got a Wikipedia page. And there's a quote that says, I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me. Ran for the House in 2010 and did not win. In April 2020, he said he supported the president. He supported President Trump. So anyway, I don't know shit about this guy this morning. And I'm gonna play a few minutes of this. So this is John Solomon interviewing Georgia State Representative Vernon Jones. if I can get to it.
Democrat who dared to support Donald Trump joins us again. Representative, good to have you on the show again.
Thank you, John, for having me. I wasn't sure if you liked me enough. You know, it took you long enough to get me back on.
Oh, we loved you. Trust me. And our, more importantly, our listeners and viewers loved you. That's all that mattered. So that's great. Yeah. We're so honored to have you on. So help us understand what we're going through in this country right now. Let's start with your home state of Georgia. What's the latest? What do you make of Georgia right now?
Well, John, let me tell you, there's a couple things happening here. But right quick, first of all, there's litigation moving forward. We've hired Lynn Wood.
Right, you know, yeah, tremendous lawyer. Him, right?
The young man's, yeah, he is amazing. So he's fallen through the lawsuit. At the same time, there's been pressure on the Secretary of State to have this recount. So he's announced yesterday there will be a recount. It takes about 5 days. And I mean, it's going to be a hand count,
yeah,
recount, John.
Old fashioned.
If you will. Yes. And so when you talk about 5 million ballots cast, and when you look at, you have 159 counties in Georgia, everybody at the local level will be doing the recount. And John, I think one of the biggest things that people are more concerned about than anything else was those mail-in ballots. And as you know, that's what the president talked about. And that's where the exposure is on a lot of this election fraud. And I call it election fraud versus voter fraud. The Democrats want to say there's no voter fraud. And when somebody votes and they're dead, that's election fraud. Right. All right. And so when you look at ballots haven't been signed, when you look at even their signatures, where these machines are with software, that's another thing that's being looked at, the software and the hardware. And these machines, do they recognize signatures? So there's enough there, John, to really move forward with addressing these concerns. The voters should be, and they are concerned about it. Here's what I don't understand. The Democrats always talk about a free and transparent election. Who complained more about voter fraud than Stacey Abrams and her group? And so here they are. The Democrats do not want us to count these ballots again. The election is close. The irony of the hypocrisy of it, John.
Yeah, it's remarkable how the tables returned from 2018 when so many of the Democrats were yelling foul to today. What do you make of the turnout? I mean, you've been in this state and in politics for 30 years, been at the top of service, and you know how the state operates. We know the president turned out his vote. How did so much Democrat vote turn out? And, you know, are you confident that there's real, when we say election fraud, people who did not vote that are listed as voted, do you think there are shadow votes, dead voters? How confident are you that there's a substantial number of bad votes in this election?
John, if you go back and look at this carefully, who have been pushing for day one on mail-in ballots? It's been the Democrats. Right. It's been Stacey Abrams and her group, Unfair Fight. That's the biggest exposure in this election, those mail-in ballots. Now, when you break that down with 5 million votes and a difference of 12,000, the president's people came there that day and voted that day. That day of the election, it shouldn't be that much still of a difference between election day and early voting. And I tell you why, or let's say mail-in ballots, because many people who were scared by the pandemic, although it's serious, don't get me wrong,
right.
A lot of seniors and others, and not necessarily those who are frail seniors, but a lot of those well seniors who felt like, okay, I think I'm going to send my ballot in. I'll vote through the mail-in ballot. Well, it's strange. I think you should have had a lot higher number for the president in those ballots. So either the election was about even Steve with those mail-in ballots, or there was an emphasis so much on mail-in ballots where they were ballot harvesting.
Right.
And I think that's where the issue, and that's what the president spoke about.
And let's be clear. Well, in Georgia, ballot harvesting is illegal, right? It's not appropriate for people to come and round up people's votes for them, right?
Right. Right. It's illegal.
Have you found any evidence of it?
You
have great intelligence on the ground. You know the people, the streets, the incredible activists in the state. Do you see any sign of ballot harvesting? Have you detected anyone and said, yeah, my ballot was harvested?
John, the emails that I receive and the phone calls that I receive, and that's just me as a legislator.
Right.
It's across the board. We're seeing irregularities across the board. I know how some try to narrow in. Well, give me specific evidence here. Well, for example, which is within the whole rim, the largest precinct in the state of Georgia, in Fulton County,
Atlanta area. Yep.
in the Atlanta area, when poll watchers, who by law they can be there, when poll watchers were told that we're through counting ballots right now, we're tired, staff is tired, we're going to let everybody go home, the poll watchers leave, they lock the door, and they count for another 3 hours. Wow. And there's a local media outlet here that agreed and was there when they were put out. And so when you look at this thing in totality, that's why I talk about election fraud. There were just so many different things going on. But I believe with that recount, I believe that certainly would swing in the president's favor, because I believe a lot of those ballots would be thrown out. And as those ballots are thrown out, I think that favors the president without a doubt.
Do you have any sense that any...
So that gives you a sense of it. So I'm watching this morning at what, 2:20, and I get a message from my son in Norway. So I talk to him for a few minutes, and then I go back to watching this. And I just thought, aren't these the kind of discussions that we're supposed to have if we're interested in the integrity of the system? And the answer to that is yes, but it seems to me that we're not interested in the integrity of the system anymore. So that's your, McNamara, that's your big mistake, you rube. Why would you think somebody would be interested in the integrity of the system? The only thing, all right, when your signature doesn't have to match the signature on your ballot, who would say that system is a system that we should adopt, right? I mean, it's just, I mean, it's who that believes in integrity says, yeah, when you send in your application and you sign that and that gets scanned and becomes part of our record that we could call up, the signature on your ballot doesn't have to match that signature. It only has to match the signature that's on the envelope. Well, wait a minute. That means that I can harvest ballots and that I can sign them all day. And as long as my signature on the ballot matches the one on the envelope, you're setting up the system to be corrupted. Now, here's the thing that I think is important about Georgia and the way Georgia's doing it. Georgia's going to validate for the nation, its count. We're going to be able to see whether there were software issues. We're going to be able to see whether there were hardware issues and why, because they're going to do the whole recount by hand. And so we're going to see, you know, I would expect we will see where all the warts are. And whatever happens out of that happens. But to me, most distressing, and honestly, I was not in a good mood over the weekend. I was like, what's wrong with me? And I think the bottom line for me is that when you watch this, and again, make no mistake about it, I think it's better for the Republican Party that Donald Trump goes into the fundraiser, you know, advisor, you know, he can keep his Twitter account, blowtorch guy, and other people run. I believe that that's what's best for the Republican Party. Well, as I've said, Tim Scott, Kristi Noem from South Dakota, Nikki Haley from South Carolina, I think those are all better standard bearers for a more diverse, more inclusive Republican Party. And I'm not alone in that opinion, okay? But I'll just tell you this. The people that are calling for, hey, this is over, right? To me, it's like, do you think the rest of us are fucking idiots? We've watched what you've done the last 4 years. That's about as crooked. I mean, to me, it's more crooked than Watergate. Watergate was stupid, right? But Nixon playing the game as he had seen it play. I mean, Nixon didn't make up those tricks. He didn't make up that game. He just played it. Now, to me, it's just like it's sick. And the sickest part of it is this union of gigantic social media companies, big technology, as in Google, right? And so big social media is in Facebook, Twitter, right? Throw Google in there in terms of tweaking searches to steer you to a certain content. And remember, Google controls 92% of the searches that are done on the planet. Yeah, that ought to make you feel good. Major media outlets, all with a single progressive agenda that they want to shove down your throat. And we've watched it the last 4 years. And I mean, to me, and then we even see it that Pfizer, the Tuesday after the election, announced that we've got a drug that, you know, has a 90% success rate. Yet that is announced a week after the election. And you're watching it and you're saying, holy shit, man. Holy shit. So, I mean, it's, I would tell you, I'll put the link to that. It's about 30 minutes. And his name is Vernon Jones. And it's just common sense. If you say you're interested in the system, right, and it should be grown-ups from both sides of our political spectrum that say, yeah, that's right. And it shouldn't be just this burn it the fuck down for power, which is seems to be where we are. And it's embodied, in my opinion, by Nancy Pelosi. I think she is the worst thing going for this country. And I think illustrative of the point is while our cities burned, you never saw her once, not once, go on TV and say, this is wrong. Every one of us, like I heard growing up, I will defend your right to say whatever you want to say, but I will not defend your right to be violent and destroy somebody else's hard-earned work, somebody's livelihood. That is wrong, and it needs to stop. Not once have you seen her say that. It's disgusting. Why? For the same reason that Harry Reid said in 2006, I think, the war is lost. He said that. Aided in the field the enemies that I fought, the Marines who went out every day with their rifles in Humvee, trying not to get dead by IEDs. Harry Reid abetted them for political gain. And that's the fucking game these assholes play. And it's disgusting. It's disgusting. And so to me, what, 71 million people in this country voted for a candidate? They should at least get an explanation of this is what happened. And so Donald Trump, who would have been reelected, and then COVID hits, then COVID is used as a pretense to send not the request for an absentee ballot. It's used as a pretense to send the ballot itself. To send the ballot itself. And then magically, more ballots come back across the board for President Trump's opponent. Now, again, I don't care what persuasion you are. Might that leave you a little bit of a head scratcher? I think it would. And so in the midst of that head scratching, somebody would have to say, okay, let us tell you what happened. We can tell you definitively this, 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 and this. And yes, it does seem odd, but all these signatures match, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they should be able to footnote it to you so you can believe in the system, because I'm going to tell you this right now. Right, there's a lot of people in this country who absolutely, positively do not believe in the system. Now, I want to play for you something that happened last night. It's kind of interesting because I don't know that I've ever seen it before, right? Or I don't know in my life that I've seen it I've seen it often. Now, this is an introduction, the introduction of Samuel Alito. Now, the whole speech is 30 minutes, so I'm only going to play you about 5 minutes. But Samuel Alito gives a speech last night to the Federalist Society. And I don't want to say he clicks off safe, but he starts raising concerns about the things we've seen in this country. Yeah. And so let me play you a few minutes of that. Pretty interesting stuff.
I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Thank you for joining us at this year's National Lawyers Convention, our first and hopefully last all-virtual convention. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'm very pleased to welcome you this evening. There's an apocryphal quote I'm fond of, "May you live in interesting times." I've sometimes wondered whether that quote is offered as a curse or as a blessing. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know it is clear we do in fact live in interesting times. So I thank you for taking a moment out of your interesting life to join us this evening. It is my pleasure, my honor, to introduce our keynote speaker for this year's National Lawyers Convention, a jurist who needs very little introduction. I've had the good fortune to know Justice Samuel A. Alito, Jr. for decades now, and he embodies what I hope to find not only in a jurist, but in the law itself. Steadfast resolve in the search for truth, unwavering consistency, and a single-minded fidelity to the Constitution. During his career, Justice Alito served in several positions in the U.S. Department of Justice. In Washington, he served as assistant to the Solicitor General, that part of the Department of Justice that argues cases for the United States in the Supreme Court. He then served in the front office of the Department of Justice as Deputy Assistant Attorney General. In New Jersey, he acted as an AUSA and rose to the level of United States Attorney for New Jersey in the late 1980s. It was in 1990 that he switched branches, appointed as a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. In January 2006, he took his seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And now, Justice Alito.
Thank you, Dean. I am very pleased to have this opportunity to speak to all of you who are attending the Federalist Society's annual Lawyers Convention via the Internet. I've given the convention's keynote speech several times before, but today is quite different. On all those occasions, I spoke to a live audience at the big convention dinner. By the time I got up to speak, there had been a cocktail hour. Everybody had had the chance to enjoy a glass of wine or two with dinner, and people were in a good mood. Those are optimal circumstances for a speaker. They tend to make the audience a lot more forgiving in its assessment of the speech. Today, I'm talking to a camera, and that feels really strange. And I wondered if anything could be done to alleviate that. If any of you watched any regular season baseball games this year, you will have seen that there were no real people in attendance.
His stock just went up because he said he was a baseball fan. I'm not going to lie to you.
But in an effort to make the atmosphere seem a bit more normal, teams placed cardboard cutouts of fans in the seats and piped in recorded cheers. I thought for a moment about asking the organizers of the convention to do something like that, but that would only make the setting more surreal. However, if any of you would like to enjoy a beverage in the comfort of your homes, I hope you will feel free to do so. And on the other hand, if any of you feel the urge to throw rotten tomatoes, go right ahead. You will only mess up your own screen. If you have watched some of the events of this year's convention, I hope you found them informative and thought-provoking. As in the past, they have featured speakers with a variety of views on important topics. Some of those watching tonight may be new to Federalist Society events and may have heard a lot of misinformation about the Society. So let me say a word at the outset about what the Society is, what it is not, and why I have been a member for many years. Let me start with what it is not. It is not an advocacy group. Unlike other bar groups, it does not take a position on any issue. It doesn't propose legislation or lobby or testify before Congress or file briefs in the Supreme Court or any other court. It holds events like this convention at which issues are debated and discussed openly and civilly. Anybody can join the society, and anybody can attend events like this convention. Most members of the society are conservative in the sense that they want to conserve our Constitution and the rule of law, but members disagree about many important things. The society started in law schools in the 1980s and now has 200 law school chapters, and the best law school deans have expressed appreciation of the society's contribution to free and open debate. My colleague Elena Kagan is a prime example. When she was the dean of Harvard Law School, she spoke at a Federalist Society event and began with these words, "I love the Federalist Society." After some applause, she repeated, "I love the Federalist Society." Pause, "but you are not my people." That is a true expression of the freedom of speech that our Constitution guarantees and that we need to preserve. We should all welcome rational, civil speech on important subjects, even if we do not agree with what the speaker has to say. Unfortunately, tolerance for opposing views is now in short supply in many law schools and in the broader academic community. When I speak with recent law school graduates, what I hear over and over is that they face harassment and retaliation if they say anything that departs from the law school orthodoxy. Under these circumstances, Federalist Society law school events are more important than ever. I will have more to say about freedom of speech later, but at this point, I want to express appreciation to the many judges and lawyers who stood up to an attempt to hobble the debate that the Federalist Society fosters. A move was afoot to bar federal judges from membership in the society. And if that had succeeded, the next logical step would have been to forbid them from speaking at law school events and other events sponsored by the society. Four Court of Appeals judges, Amulthar Par, Andy Oldham, Bill Pryor, and Greg Katsas, prepared a letter that devastated the arguments of those who wanted to ban membership. The letter was signed by more than 200 judges, including judges appointed by every president going back to President Ford. And at least for now, the proposal is on hold. We should all express our thanks to these defenders of free speech. The topic of this year's convention is the rule of law and the current crisis. And I take it that the title is intended primarily to refer to the COVID-19 crisis that has transformed life for the past 8 months. The pandemic has obviously taken a heavy human toll. Thousands dead, many more hospitalized, millions unemployed, the dreams of many small business owners dashed. But what has it meant for the rule of law? I'm now going to say something that I hope will not be twisted or misunderstood, but I have spent more than 20 years in Washington, so I'm not overly optimistic. In any event, here goes. The pandemic has resulted in previously unimaginable restrictions on individual liberty. Now, notice what I am not saying or even implying. I am not diminishing the severity of the virus's threat to public health. And putting aside what I will say shortly about a few Supreme Court cases, I'm not saying anything about the legality of COVID restrictions, nor am I saying anything about whether any of these restrictions represent good public policy. I'm a judge, not a policymaker. All that I'm saying is this, and I think it is an indisputable statement of fact. We have never before seen restrictions as severe, extensive, and prolonged as those experienced for most of 2020. Think of all the live events that would otherwise be protected by the right to freedom of speech, live speeches, conferences, lectures, meetings. Think of worship services. Churches closed on Easter Sunday. Synagogues closed for Passover and Yom Kippur. Think about access to the courts or the constitutional right to a speedy trial, Trials in federal courts have virtually disappeared in many places. Who could have imagined that? The COVID crisis has served as a sort of constitutional stress test, and in doing so, it has highlighted disturbing trends that were already present before the virus struck. One of these is the dominance of lawmaking by executive fiat rather than legislation. The vision of early 20th century progressives and the New Dealers of the 1930s was that policymaking would shift from narrow-minded elected legislators to an elite group of appointed experts. In a word, that policymaking would become more scientific. That dream has been realized to a large extent. Every year, administrative agencies acting under broad delegations of authority.
I like stuff like this. I know, like, you're like, oh, Mac, this is egghead stuff. But it's pretty rare that you get to hear a justice of the Supreme Court in long format. Maybe I just don't pay enough attention to it. But as he's talking about the COVID crisis and what that's meant to the nation, and you can, if you care to go look, he's already being annihilated, right? He's already being annihilated for what he says, what he will say. Well, let's do a couple more minutes, and then I'll cut to the last like 3 minutes of his speech.
Churn out huge volumes of regulations that dwarf the statutes enacted by the people's elected representatives. And what have we seen in the pandemic? Sweeping restrictions imposed, for the most part, under statutes that confer enormous executive discretion. We had a COVID-related case from Nevada, so I will take the Nevada law as an example. Under that law, if the governor finds that there is, quote, a natural, technological, or man-made emergency or disaster of major proportions, the governor can perform and exercise such functions, powers, and duties as are necessary to promote and secure the safety and protection of the civilian population. To say that this provision confers broad discretion would be an understatement. Now, again, let me be clear. I'm not disputing that.
This is judge shit, right? This is this is judge shit.
Broad wording may be appropriate in statutes designed to address.
But what happened in Michigan was she declared an emergency. I think she could do it for 45 days. And then she goes back. Then she has to go to the legislature. Well, she just keeps redeclaring emergencies, right, based on the initial emergency. And so and the state Supreme Court said, yeah, you can't do that. But these are laws along those veins.
It's a wide range of emergencies, the nature of which may be hard to anticipate. And I'm not passing judgment on this particular statute. I want to make two different points. First, what we see in this statute and in what was done under it is a particularly developed example of where the law in general has been going for some time, in the direction of government by executive officials who were thought to implement policies based on expertise and, in the purest form, scientific expertise. Second, laws giving an official so much discretion can, of course, be abused. And whatever one may think about the COVID restrictions, we surely don't want them to become a recurring feature after the pandemic has passed.
And I will give you the authority to send not the request for an absentee ballot to everyone, but the authority to send a ballot to everyone certainly had an impact on the election. And that was not done for altruistic reasons. That was done to increase the chance of success. Okay? And that's the system that is being abused. Now, I just want to – I'll play the last – he goes to about 49 minutes – so let me start at 46 minutes. This is the last 3 minutes of his talk.
The Constitution should be interpreted in accordance with its public meaning at the time of adoption, and textualism, which is essentially originalism applied to statutes. To see the extent of his influence, consider these two statements by Justice Kagan. Quote, we're all originalists now, and quote, we're all textualists now. What do they mean? These statements do not mean that all jurists are in complete agreement about how the Constitution and statutes should be interpreted. But what they mean is that a lot of the debate about constitutional and statutory interpretation now takes place within the framework of, or at least using the language of, those two theories. And going forward, a lot of the debate among Justice Scalia's admirers will probe his understanding of these theories. I will not go deeply into that subject now, but I will say that we have seen the emergence of what I believe are erroneous elaborations of Justice Scalia's theories. And I look forward to friendly and fruitful debate about where his thinking leads. As I discussed tonight, the COVID crisis has highlighted constitutional fault lines, and I've criticized some of what the Supreme Court has done, but I don't want to leave you with a distorted picture. During my 15 years on the court, a lot of good work has been done to protect freedom of speech, religious liberty, and the structure of government created by the Constitution. All of this is important. But in the end, there is only so much that the judiciary can do to preserve our Constitution and the liberty it was adopted to protect. As Learned Hand famously wrote, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no Constitution, no law, no court can do much to help it. For all Americans, standing up for our Constitution and our freedom is work that lies ahead. It will not be easy work. But when we meet next year, I hope we will be able to say that progress was made.
So that is, I'll put that link in here. You can listen to the whole, it's about 35 minutes. And he's pretty critical of the direction of the country in terms of the limitations on religious liberty and some other things. So he's been annihilated, as you can imagine, in the news today. The we'll begin the program here, or we'll at least pause the program. It is Friday, the 13th. In case you don't believe in the Friday the 13th jinx. Good for you. If you do, this is dedicated to you. Good luck to you today. And this is dedicated to everybody who's been feeling like me that, like, I don't really know what's going on in this country, but I don't feel good about it. And, you know, the stupid games that get played in our country that are just naked political power grabs that somehow or other get through state legislatures, especially relative to voting. And I don't care what side you're on, in my opinion, are disgusting. You know, votes are, we're supposed to be able to look at a vote and say, yeah, we believe that. And again, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but I don't believe in coincidence. As I often say, the Iraqis cured me of that. Right? If you believe in coincidence, you're a fucking rube. And if you don't ask hard questions when you see so many coincidences happen, then you are a fucking rube and you get what you get. And so I believe the recount and the audit in Georgia is really important to the country because it will lay open. And I hope the same thing is court mandated if it's not taken up by the states of Pennsylvania, of Michigan, and any other place where the vote was close. Because they have a moral responsibility to the citizens of this country to supply the footnotes and say, no, it was done on the up and up. And to those states with those laws that don't force people to produce ID, to produce, nobody's trying to disenfranchise anybody. But who the fuck doesn't have an ID? Who can't prove who they are in this country? Who is that? And so, to me, this game that gets played primarily by the Democratic Party, you know, of open voting, it's bullshit. And then you wind up here where you're at now, not simply having to re-educate people about why we have an electoral college, why the nation was put together like that. We're not just having to go through a history lesson. We're looking at elections and saying, I don't believe that was fair. I don't believe that there's any integrity in that vote. I mean, and then what happens, you couple that with the censorship that exists in our country today, like, you know, most of us have never seen it. And you wonder why people pick up guns. Because they're pissed. They're pissed. And, you know, certainly everybody hopes that doesn't happen. But with the wackos among us, do you honestly believe that it won't? I pray that it won't. So this is dedicated to everybody that has looked at this system and shaken their head and saying, you know, this is not right. We ought to be able to conduct an election in this country and to be able to look at the people that vote and say, no, we can vouch that, we can attest that everybody here who voted is a citizen of the state. We can tell you that these votes were checked and rechecked, and this is the will of the people of XYZ state. Pretty important shit. I don't think we're there yet. And certainly doesn't look good. And then on top of that, you know, you have the people that burned it down on Donald Trump from the day he was elected to today are now telling everybody else, oh, we all need to work together. We all need to put all that aside. It's like somebody punches you in the face and punches you in the face and punches you in the face and they say, okay, let's be friends now. You know, what is the answer to that? Hey, fuck you, man. How about if I do to you what you did to me? And then we could talk about being friends. And I would tell you this. I think that the Republicans and conservatives of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party should absolutely do that to Joe Biden. And then maybe people would say, you know what, this is no way to exist as a nation. That, yeah, we did it to them, and then they did it to us, and we've got nothing done over the course of, you know, 8 years, except by executive orders, and those are quickly undone. And we need to find a way to restore compromise in our government. We need to find a way to restore, you know, articulate discourse in our government. And we as leaders have to take our leadership responsibilities seriously, which they don't. So this is dedicated to that proposition. All of that. Yeah, all of that lengthy proposition.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore. So, young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You gotta win.
Happy birthday to my nephew, Joe. He's 23 today, halfway to 46. That's right. Currently in Quantico, partly sunny and 57 down the coast of Camp Lejeune. It is cloudy and 64. Out 29 Palms, it is sunny and 55, so a little bit warmer. Pendleton, sunny and 54, colder. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dawn is breaking. Mostly cloudy and 71. Okinawa, dark cloudy, 68. In Darwin, it is clear, dark, and 83. Yeah, Darwin, warm. In Norway. My son just sent me a picture of the Northern Lights, right? Yeah. I mean, I was supposed to be able to see them in North Dakota, but I don't ever recall seeing them. So, yeah. Yeah, but they're beautiful. Anyway, in Norway, it is in Oslo, Norway, it is late in the afternoon, cloudy and 43. At the home of All Marine Radio, sunny and 58. Looking for a high of 64 today. And then 68 tomorrow. You know, it said mid-60s yesterday and got up to 69. So I would imagine we'll be warmer than that today as a warming front comes in. Yeah, 75 on Sunday, 77 Monday, 73 on Tuesday. How about that? Got that going for you. So, that is a look at your weather here. We'll take a break. I don't know if Greg Lotus is going to join us. Now, I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, but the chef told me that he might call. But chef's still got some pain in his back. So I told I said, well, what the fuck does pain in your back have to do with your mouth? He told me to take it easy. He said, you need to settle the fuck down. I said, all right, I'm asking, man. Come on, this is mental health for you. You know that. He said, I know. I'll see what I can do. So I said, okay. But before we go to the break, there's a couple things I want to mention. It's things I saw in the news early this morning. I'm a huge fan of Elizabeth Smart, right? The Elizabeth Smart Foundation launches the We Believe You campaign. So this is I'm reading from kind of a press release. Maybe I should go to the Elizabeth Smart Foundation website. How about that? Dermac. Elizabeth Smart Foundation. There she is. Here's some statistics. An estimated 1 million women are raped every year. Only 3% of rapists will ever spend a single day in jail. 1 in 3 females will experience sexual violence in their lives. An American, both male and female, is assaulted every 73 seconds. 80% of assault survivors were assaulted in their home. How about that? 50% of sexual assaults occur on dates. Females between the age of 15 and 24 are at the greatest risk. Only 6 out of every 100 sexual assaults are reported to the police. 80% of assailants are friends and family of the victim. One in 10 children will be sexually abused before the age of 18. So let me give you the website. The website is ElizabethSmartFoundation.org. The program is called We Believe You. And there's a quote on the billboard. It says, I pledge to stand with victims of sexual violence. I support you. I love you. And I believe you. And then there's a button on there. And it says to learn more. So if you click on that, you see the Elizabeth Smart Foundation logo, which is kind of an angel, right? And then the emblem, We Believe You. And again, I would just tell you, I mean, this strikes such a huge sympathetic chord in me, because I would tell you that the one thing that I didn't know as a leader who spent a lifetime in the Marine Corps, I did not realize how much of this was resident in human beings long before they ever made a decision to become Marines. I mostly didn't know it and didn't deal with it. And so I would recommend that you take a look at it. And that is the Elizabeth Smart Foundation. Again, she's just a phenomenal human being and continues to do phenomenal things. So We Believe You. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a break. The chef joins the program in a very impromptu way coming up next.